Welcome to the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, talking about everything in between, a little bit of femme, a little bit of EM. I'm Risa E. Lewis, host for the Feminem Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Michelle Johnston.
How exciting to be here. Thank you so much for asking me, Risa.
Michelle Johnston is an emergency physician. She's not just an emergency physician, she's an Australian emergency physician. She's a proud member of Feminem. She's a proud member of NOEM, that's the Network of Women in Emergency Medicine. That's not our focus today. Our focus today, audience, is her novel, her first novel. This is called Dustfall. I can't tell you how excited I am, Michelle, to have you on the show, specifically because I've just completed the book. It spoke to me on so many levels. We've had a little bit of a pre-meet and a pre-chat to talk about some of the clarifying moments for me, but let's start by having you tell us about yourself.
Yes, that's always a very loaded question, isn't it? How would I summarize myself for you? I would just essentially say I'm kind of odd, maybe a non-fitter innerer, sort of a kind of peripatetic way to get to where I am now, which is, I guess, emergency physician and writer. I think I'm one of these people that always felt a load of guilt that I never really fit in or never was quite doing what I ought to be doing. And it's only now that I look back that I'm glad that I've been able to do all the things, being a mum, being an emergency physician, training in a trauma centre, teaching, being a clinician, and then going on to be a writer, that they've all sort of smooshed together. And now I'm very happy being able to do all of these things at once, not terribly well all at the same time, but doing my best.
Now, my experience, Michelle, people who write, it's not something that you do haphazardly. It's not a weekend warrior thing. It tends to be a habit. It tends to be an exercise, and you have to do it regularly and you have to do it ritually. And so one thing I'm interested in is, what is your style and what is your ritual as an author?
You're absolutely right about that. And I find that even if I go for a couple of days without writing, I rust up. I lose my writing fitness, if you like. And so I need to do it somehow every day. And then that will just depend upon my day and my requirements and all those other pulls and levers that are applied to one in this life. But I will make time to do it every day, and I make time to read every day. I think sometimes it's the reading that is just as important as the writing, because that feeds me all the time. And I read as widely as I can, read crazy things, ridiculous things, unexpected things to get those inspirations. But from a writing perspective, I will try and write for at least a couple of hours every day. And if that has to be at 5 in the morning, damn it, so be it. If it has to happen, I need obviously to be reasonably uninterrupted, noise cancelling headphones, and it's kind of an odd thing to do, particularly when you're a person of science, a person of a structured life. But you need to sort of step away from that and go into crazy world a little bit, go into a world where you can, where you think differently, you use your mind differently. So I've learned to become rather disciplined about that switching from normal brain to writer's brain, because let me tell you, they're not the same thing.
Right. Now, one thing I've seen in writers is often they surround themselves with a community. They either have a writing group or they get together periodically to review each other's work or to read pieces of their work to get feedback. Is that a part of your habit?
Absolutely. I have a writing group that I've been with for years that we throw each other everything that we've written, even if it's for blog posts or, our manuscripts that we're working on. And we've learnt to hold each other's hearts gently, knowing how difficult the feedback process is. And it is a very difficult thing to take on feedback, to give feedback. And it's a very much a learnt skill. Because everything you write is so personal, it's
very much,
it is an extension of your own brain. And what do you love more than your own brain? So you have to learn that skill. So I consider my world half writing and half the writing world community as much as medicine. The two don't really surprisingly fit together as well as you might think. I actually kind of see them as quite separate worlds.
Interesting. You know, when I read the book, So Dust Fall, there's actually a lot of medicine and medical injected into it. So if you were to give the 2-minute elevator speech summary of the plot, what would you share with our readers?
Well, I think I like to think about it as like a novel of duality. I think, like I was just talking about the two worlds being separate, writing and medicine. This is a novel that sort of has two parts that wind around each other. There are two main storylines. There's the story of it's the story of medical error, and it's the story of the mining period up in the northwest of Western Australia in a town called Whitnoom, which was one of the few places in the world that ever mined blue asbestos. And it is a heinous chapter in West Australia, in Australia's history. It's shocking. So it's those two stories that wind around each other, and it's written in two time frames. It's a dual narrative story. There's a reasonably contemporary story of a female doctor who's made a terrible mistake and she's running away from there as far as she possibly can. And there's a more historical doctor who comes out from England, sort of a bumbling, poetic, slight fool of a man whom I adore, who came out to Whitnoom to work as their medical superintendent at the time of the when the mining was at its peak.
Now, readers, if you're wondering to what extent will I identify with this book, well, I understand if this is an Australian physician and a British physician and medical error, is it the same or is it different? I will tell you, the story and the scenarios described by Michelle are spot on. They resonate a lot with what we experience in the United States in emergency medicine, the challenges and how much medical error can really tear you up. The even portrayal, I don't think it's giving away too much to talk about. There's actually a malpractice case that one of the characters is dueling with, I will say. And even the way she navigates that and deals with it, and even the way the ultimate outcome of that is very reflective of what happens here in the United States. Michelle, I told you I was going to ask you this question, so here goes. To what extent is this novel autobiographical?
Yes. Okay. Well, look, the podcast answer to that, Razor, is not at all.
The podcast answer and the alternative?
The truth, of course, which will never get out there, is it's completely autobiographical in many ways, as most novels are. So there's degrees of autobiographical. To write a novel from the heart, you know, you need to draw on every experience you've ever had, experience that you've seen, emotions, feelings, the most subtle things you've seen, you've sensed, you've done, you've been a part of. So from that perspective, it's extremely autobiographical. Now, the error that you're talking about, and it isn't giving too much away, it's very clear from the start that Lou, the contemporary doctor, has made a terrible mistake, certainly in her eyes. And she, her life has become derailed. She blames herself, and she doesn't deal with it particularly well. She runs away. She drinks. She's angry. She doesn't know how to deal with it. And one of the ways she starts to deal with it is by writing. The error that she makes is not a terrible mistake. It's not a malignant mistake. It's a confluence of systemic problems, as are the vast majority of mistakes. And that mistake that she makes is very much based on something that I did myself early in my career, which is why I was able to write it so clearly.
Another aspect of the book that I shared with you that I just loved was sort of the richness of language. And in general, if anybody follows you on Twitter, and after this podcast, they had better follow you on Twitter, your use of language it's witty, it is smart, it is rich, and it's particularly rich with some medical terms. In fact, I pulled two out that I'm going to share on the podcast. You write at one point talking about a sugar bowl and bugs in the sugar bowl, and you write small bugs that had suicided in the sugar, which it's so visual. We've been there. We've seen little bugs in the sugar or in the salt or whatever sitting on the kitchen table. A second one I really liked, the kitchen had grown gravid with dark. gravid with dark. I just think it's just so rich and beautiful and injected with medical. Now, I think I also asked that you select a piece to read from the novel, and I'm wondering if you have that on the ready, and if not, we can come back to that.
I do have it on the ready. I wouldn't ordinarily have it on the ready, but luckily you'd asked beforehand. I have been at a number of writing festivals, and I'm never entirely sure which is the best passage to read, and sometimes I misread the room, and I've read out the autopsy chapter to a bunch of students, and it never went down. It didn't go down at all well. But I'm going to read right smack bang from the middle of the book from a chapter called The Misery. In the days to come, days laced with misery and loss, the people of Wittenoom would comment on the curious nature of the blast. How strange it was that only odd windows blew out of certain buildings, forming peculiar patterns, including two on perfectly opposite sides of the Fortescue Hotel. Rather like a puzzle, one of the wives would say later. How a gentle rain of cinders floated delicately up the streets, finding its way into unexpected corners, laying quietly on windowsills and doorsteps, elegant and ornamental in arrangement, and how several wooden beams which fell ended up leaning daintily into each other, poised as if for a kiss. But in those first few hours, when the town was dense with screams and blood and shards of bone, nobody noticed a thing except for the frantic desire to locate the ones they loved and the others they needed. Up through the street and beyond, like the climax of an operatic score, screams rang out. In the pub, where Raymond had sat just a moment before in congenial reflection, people were reaching out in panic. They grabbed for their friends, their wallets, their hats. Others just pushed themselves off the furniture to get out. But where? The street outside was rumbling with fire and the pounding of feet. People, confused about where to exit, crisscrossed and slammed into one another. Raymond himself stood in robotic fashion, straightened his tie, put several coins on the bar and walked directly out the front into the hazy street. Without much conscious thought, he advanced down the slope of the road, where he expected to come across the wounded, the injured, the source of the screaming, but all he saw were townsfolk running, crying, crossing the road back and forth. The fuel of hysteria could be felt burning in the same way as the last struts of the storehouse. As he moved closer to the cloud of smoke and the wafting of ash, he saw a man half carrying, half dragging out another man. They passed Raymond without looking. Another man appeared, staggering out from what was presumably the culprit building, and the xanthus smoke swirled like liquid around him, the fumes closing behind him as he went. Billowing, black-edged gusts obscured any detail. It was difficult to identify what was building and what was air. So that's just a little bit right from the middle.
Yes, I remember this scene very, very well. Very well. So mining, asbestos, and mesothelioma, how much did you know about these processes ahead of time, and which parts were actually determined by your preparation and writing of the book?
Well, this is a kind of an interesting story, how the whole book was set up in Wittenoom, and it goes back to 1991 when I was a little fresh-faced intern, just graduated from medical school, and one of the very first jobs I did, I was flung up to the northwest to this place called Port Hedland, which actually also features in the book, not very kindly, I'm afraid. Apologies, Port Hedland. And it was terrifying. I was there and I was rostered onto the emergency department overnight on my own without any help. And it was utterly, utterly terrifying. We'd never do that in terms now. And one of the things I did was I drove a car out and discovered these. This town of Wittenoom, which was by then this sort of wild west, almost ghost town, clinging onto its existence. And I came across this hospital, which was half ruined and exactly like I described it, like the Mary Celeste.
Wow.
Like it had only just been abandoned. There was gauze on the floor, walls crumbling down. And it just parked itself in my memory for 20 years. And when I came to write the book about sending a doctor who'd made a mistake out to somewhere, this image flared itself up in my mind, and I thought, oh, that's a good place to send a doctor. I'll send her there. And I wrote this story, and it wasn't very good because all first drafts of first novels are not. And then I realized as I rewrote and rewrote, if I was going to use that place, if I was going to use that hospital, I had to do the story of Whitnoom justice. I had to do those people who died justice. I was going to use their story. And that required an enormous amount of research, years of research. I went back up there. I read everything I could. I interviewed people who'd been there to get the story of Whitnoom, the story of asbestos, the stories of mesothelioma right. So a lot went into that. And most of it, of course, happened by serendipity. I hadn't really planned to write the story of Whitnoom. But what's very interesting is that Whitnoom has been very, very little written about. There's a massive cover-up, government, corporate cover-up. And there were all these epiphanies I had when writing the book. And one of them was this incredible juxtaposition between what happens when an individual makes a mistake versus how a corporation behaves after they've made a mistake when lives are at stake. And that was such a fascinating, and that was the other duality that came to me when I was writing it, how they work together, the individual versus the corporation and the government. So there was massive cover up. So it was very difficult to get a lot of information, but I didn't stop.
Michelle Johnston, investigative reporter, live from Perth, Australia. So, I mean, now that the book is published and audience, it's available online, Amazon.com and other places. Michelle, I don't know if you're aware, but you actually have some reviews on Amazon that I may or may not have investigated. And just so you know, you have 5 out of 5 stars and you've got nothing but very, very positive reviews. I'll just read. One says, "Treat yourself, so worth the read." Now, the other question is, do you know these people that wrote this? But I'm kidding. So someone wrote, a sneakily good read. Once finished, the story will stay with you. The third reviewer said, a deeply beautiful novel. It moves on several levels. It made me want to be a better person and better doctor. So kudos and compliments to you, dear author.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's so extraordinary when another person, another individual, a single person really connects with the book and they think about it. It's the greatest honor you can do a writer, that a writer can have, if a single person reads it and connects with, you know, the book took me 6 years to write. 6 years of, there was a lot of tears. There was a lot of gnashing of teeth, a lot of blood spilt in order to get it as good as I could. And to have this reciprocated honor, I guess, of a reader and a writer together, that's, I don't think a writer could ever want for anything more. I have no real interest in lists or, you know, even awards. I mean, I can't say no interest, but it's really not the important thing. The important thing is one single person reading and being involved with that story. So, you know, I'm forever grateful. Of course, there'll be bad reviews as well, but utterly amazing to hear those words.
What can you share with us about what you're working on now and what your second novel is about?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I'm what's called a pantser. They talk about the two types of writers, plotters and pantsers. And the plotters are the ones who are organized and think about things and plan things in advance. And you can imagine what the opposite is. Well, I think if there was a scale of plotters versus pantsers, then I'm just so off the scale to the right, it's ridiculous. So I don't know is the long-winded answer to that question. I do know and I don't know. I'm on version 18 and I'm still calling it a first draft. And I sort of have to let the characters do what they want to before I interfere too much. So the story will change. I can tell you, I'd love to be able to tell you the working title. In fact, I'm going to. You guys are going to be the first ones to hear it in the world. So a slight drum roll, and it may well change. In fact, it probably will change. But it's called The Accidental Alchemist. And it has it's got some themes of big pharma, anti-science. I write all these little notes down to myself about what I think the theme might be, and I've got one right here on a sticky note in capital letters. I'm shouting myself. It says, "Do not get between a man and his power." So that's as much as I can tell you about the next novel.
So this strikes me as you can take the physician out of the author, but you can't take the author out of the physician. It sounds there might be a little bit of medical, it's a bit medically informed in its theme.
It is absolutely medically informed. And I thought for the second novel, I tried very hard to get away from writing anything medical, just so I didn't particularly want to be pigeonholed as the doctor writer. But this story has come so compelling, come screaming out of my head that it's essentially writing itself, and I've got no choice. I just have to succumb, suffer, you know, along with the characters, and that's just how it will be. And the less I fight that, I think the better.
Well, I certainly look forward to this next magnum opus. Michelle, I won't see you in person until Fix 19, which is upon us pretty soon in September of 2019. But before then, we will be seeing you certainly on Twitter. I'll make sure in the show notes readers know how to get a hold of you, how to find your book, as well as some of your other blog pieces. I really want to thank you for taking the time out of your very busy day and scheduling this with me 12 hours ahead of where I am in the USA, 12 hours behind where you are in Australia. Final words for the readers, specifically final words for those listening who think, yeah, I think I have a novel in me. What should I do?
Oh, you absolutely do have a novel in you. And writing is the ultimate joy. You don't have to write to be published. You don't have to write to get reviews, but writing is amazing. And I'm just going to, I have, after many, many years, figured out my own secret to writing well, and I'd love to be able to share that. And that is you must pay attention. You must see things anew. You must think of things anew, and you must write things in new ways. And if you can do those three things, you can write anything.
I love it. Michelle, thank you very much. We'll see you again soon, audience. Thank you.
Thank you.